And we have with us in the studios once again, Joff Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning.
Hello.
Good morning.
Whoop.
Goodness, am I on?
Hello?
Hello. Ah, hello, there we go. Is. Hi. I'm still on the cell phone. I'm actually about 10 blocks from the station.
No. We're trying that remote hookup for... Yeah. That we're going to use when
nine blocks.
Yeah, when you're going to be you're going to be gone in the next couple of weeks, right?
I'll be gone next week. I should be back in a couple of weeks, but I will be in probably about somewhere in the middle of Arkansas about this time next week. So,
all right,
lucky me, huh?
You're having a big meeting with Bill Clinton, I understand.
Yeah. Actually, I got this great lead on a real estate deal that the state attorney general's wife clued me in on. Actually, it sounds really good.
Yeah. Excellent. Lots of water there, I hear.
Yeah, exactly. It's waterfront property, and the brochure looks just fabulous. I'm really looking forward to seeing it.
Okay. Well, another week of slowly diminishing coverage of Iraq. You know, a lot of people like to think it's over and done with. So we
all over. We bought them freedom. It's done now. Move along. We got somewhere else we can bring freedom.
Yeah, we've had continuous coverage for so long. Now we're getting the spot coverage, and a lot of it's coverage of bad stuff that's happening there. And every time something like that happens, you hear somebody, whether it's in the Pentagon or the U.S. government or even in the media, say, "Oh gosh, well at least we brought them freedom."
And this is the spot coverage of the bad stuff comes when they're not particularly inclined to show the bad stuff. There's just so much of it happening that they have to acknowledge it every now and then.
That's right. They have to acknowledge the stuff that's pretty open and pretty egregious. But whenever they say, gosh, at least we brought them freedom, I start making a list in my head of the other things that we've brought them in addition to freedom. And I just wanted to share with you like the top 10 items on my list of what the U.S. military and the U.S. government has brought Iraq in addition to freedom. Number one on my list is crime.
No, you don't watch Letterman very often, do you? You're supposed to do that from number 10 and work up.
Yeah, and we were supposed to have music for you, but we didn't get that until.
No. The list builds, but I want to start with number one. Number one is crime. The looting's still going on, especially in Baghdad and other cities, and especially at night. Most people can't go out. When people do go out to work, they have to leave at least one adult member at home with a gun to protect their homes.
And we're getting more and more arming of ordinary people in the country because they want to try and protect their homes and their possessions.
Right. And after the war, there were such huge stocks of military weapons left laying around, grenades, automatic weapons, rifles, unexploded ordnance, that people are now armed to the teeth. So crime is becoming a really, really big problem, and people are getting shot every day just because of looters and because they're trying to stop looting. Number two on my list is poverty. No one can find work except for a few people who are working for the new U.S. administration there. Those people who do get a job with the U.S. administration are paid very little. Oftentimes, they only get a single $20 payment with the promise of, oh, eventually we'll pay you a salary. And the Iraqis look at that $20 and they go, I can't feed myself, much less my family, on this.
Yeah, and also, now are they being paid in dinar or are they being paid in U.S. dollars?
I believe they're being paid in U.S. dollars.
That's what I thought. So we've also had this
because
this
they
whole,
wouldn't take dinar.
Yeah, exactly. So we've had this whole conversion of the economy suddenly to a 1-to-1 U.S. dollar economy, which devalues
the dinar.
Yeah. And also wipes out people's savings.
Right,
yeah.
People's savings are not worth anything now. And you have to remember, too, that businesses were looted alongside Iraqi government buildings. So many businesses can't open because they have nothing to sell or they have no computers or furniture or cash registers or anything.
And the money that they had to get more stock is now worthless.
Right. And the ones that weren't looted that do open don't have any customers because nobody has any money. They've spent most of their money on food during the war and the weeks since. So that brings up my third item, which is hunger. People's food stores are running out. There's not a good, consistent food supply line. Aid organizations are not able to get everywhere in the country because there's still a lot of shooting and a lot of looting, and it's not safe. And few aid organizations are willing to work directly with the U.S. military as a chaperone because it makes it much harder for them to continue their neutral position as an NGO, they feel. So there aren't very many NGOs in Iraq right now, and the ones that are not able to go everywhere. So people are starting to run out of food, and they're starting to go hungry. Number four on my list is imported oil. Iraq, which was a major oil exporter, is now having to import oil and cooking gas and fuel for the next month because the United States cannot get the oil infrastructure, which was damaged during the bombing and was damaged by looters, cannot get that infrastructure going again. And so you have these enormous long lines of cars, 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 blocks long, at Iraqi gas stations. They can't get their tanks filled. They can't go to work. They can't transport food from farms to the cities without oil. And it's becoming a dire situation. They now have to import oil. Number five on my list is thirst. Many of the salination plants that would clean the water in Iraq, because Iraq doesn't have mountains. It's a flat country. They get their water from the river delta. It has a lot of salt in it, so it needs to be desalinized. And it often has a lot of waste in it as well, agricultural waste, some sewage, some industrial waste, and so it needs to be cleaned. Many of those plants that did that work were damaged during the war, and afterwards when looters came and stole things like pumps and parts and supplies. And also since then, because the hot season has started, people who don't have water elsewhere will go to the few functioning pipelines that they can find and have been poking holes in them and stealing water. And making it much, much harder to get those lines and those stations up and running again.
And that entire system was already pretty fragile going all the way back to the Gulf War in 91 because of the effects of the economic sanctions over the years. So
it was hard to get parts.
You had a lot of bad equipment. You had a lot of stuff that had not been fixed over the years. And so when you have the infrastructure being damaged like that, you don't have the backup systems. You don't have the secondary facilities that people can turn to.
Right. And when the bombing started, it made it infinitely worse because it damaged what was a barely functioning system in the first place. And because people can't find clean water to drink or to bathe in, they've been going to the rivers and they've been using filthy water. And that brings up number six on my list, which is disease. This week, the World Health Organization announced that it expects a cholera epidemic in southern Iraq. People who aren't familiar with cholera can look it up in the library or online, and they can find that cholera can strike anyone in a population that has to deal, that only has dirty water to drink or to bathe in. It's a diarrheal disease, and it kills predominantly young children and older people, but it can kill anyone. 17 cases were reported in Basra in just one 24-hour period this week. The UN expects other diseases to follow as well, including hepatitis and malaria. And, of course, the main cause for all of these diseases is filthy standing water and the absence of clean running water. Iraq's hospital system, which was heavily looted after the war, is overtaxed right now. Most of their scanty supplies of antibiotics are gone. They were used up on war victims. And many hospitals don't have even hospital beds or even staff to staff the hospital because those staff are at home, unable to get to work because there's no gas, and unable to leave their homes because of looters. That brings up number seven on my list, which is just plain old death. The proliferation of abandoned Iraqi munitions, looted police weapons, along with thousands of landmines, unexploded bombs and artillery shells, unexploded cluster bombs, and the dust and remnants of depleted uranium munitions have all posed an enormous and continuing threat to the Iraqi people. And it's going to mean lots more death after the war than occurred during the war. And then we tend to think, well, gosh, you know, people are dying, sure, they're sick, sure, but at least they're free, right? Well, not so. Number eight on my list is censorship. Okay, now remember, the U.S. military bombed Iraqi TV and radio stations during the war. Those that are still functioning are now coming to the attention of the U.S. military occupiers. For example, in Mosul, a U.S. military commander sent troops not to seize the station, but to censor what the station broadcasts, because he didn't like the fact that the station, in addition to broadcasting NBC and other foreign media, also broadcast Al Jazeera. And he in particular objected to Al Jazeera news being shown on this station, along with many other news programs, mind you. But now that station has to go through a censorship process in order to stay on the air.
In other words, the censorship coming from the actual programming that comes from Arab or Muslim or Persian culture, as opposed to being imported Western,
right.
Western
culture
viewpoints,
is
Western
fine.
News.
Yeah, Western culture is fine.
Well, it is the beginning
of,
I think it is the beginning of sweeps month, so...
Yeah, there you go. So if they can get the additional ratings. So 50 Cent would be okay, but yeah, none of that Al Jazeera.
Right. So in the few places where they do have some kind of media still operating, because in most cities there is no TV station operating and the radio stations are off the air, there is censorship. Number 9 on my list is dictatorship. A lot of people are going to sit up in their seats and go, that's not true. But it is true. While the U.S. State Department is doing their dog and pony show, rolling around the country, setting up little town meetings for people to come, you know, special people that were invited to come, the people that were selected by the State Department to come and talk about what they might like to see in a government, these very vague and aimless discussions, the Pentagon is moving right ahead rapidly with five groups, predominantly Iraqi exiles, and they're setting up an interim government in Baghdad. That's been going on this week. You can go online. You can read it in British newspapers. You probably won't find it much here in American papers. If you can find a link to Associated Press or Reuters, you might be able to find some information on it, too. But Iraqi exiles, including Ahmad Chalabi, are busy setting up a new government for Iraq while the State Department just kind of fiddles, pretending that they're bringing some kind of democracy to Iraq.
Yeah, and let's be clear about this. The United States government has said very clearly, and this includes the State Department, this includes Colin Powell, that they are not going to allow a government in Iraq that does not pursue policies that the United States wants it to pursue. So what we have under the best of conditions, even if these dog and pony shows do lead to any kind of local democracy, is the United States saying, sure, you can govern yourselves all you want as soon as that government does exactly what we want them to do. That still is, I mean, you know, regardless of who fills those seats, that still is a dictatorship, because the United States is dictating what the Iraqi people will have as public policy. Now, the United States is going one step further. They're also dictating who's going to fill those seats, which is even more egregious.
Yeah, and in addition, they just put forward before the UN Security Council a resolution. The U.S. just put forward a resolution that would allow all control of the economy to remain in the United States' hands, the ability to decide how to collect oil revenue and where to spend it, with an international committee of the IMF and World Bank, U.S.-controlled institutions, and maybe one or two representatives from the U.N. to audit the books once a year.
Well, they're doing such a stellar job here. Okay, what's number 10?
And number 10 on my list is humiliation. This is the one that we don't see hardly at all in the press here. But if you start reading, really digging into what's going on there, you find that Iraqis have to stand in line for food, water, gasoline, and jobs. And when they get and they also have to stand in line for medical care. And when they get anything, it's not enough. It's not enough food to feed their families. It's not enough water to drink and to bathe in. And you have to remember that Islam has very strict requirements for people to bathe before they pray. Most people can't do that. And that is humiliating. People have to stand in line for gasoline. Often when they get to the pumps, there's none left. There's none available. So they're pushing their cars around from one station to the next, trying to find gas so that they can get to work. Those that do work have the most humiliating jobs imaginable. Now, the U.S. military has some people working for them. A lot of them are Kuwaitis and Saudis. The Kuwaitis and Saudis get paid about 200 times more than what the Iraqis get paid who work for the U.S. administration. And the Iraqis that are working for the U.S. administration are doing the most humiliating jobs, mopping the floors, taking out the garbage, cleaning the toilets. That is the ultimate humiliation.
Yeah, and that includes for people who might have been highly trained and had professional jobs in the past. A couple further things about that. Number one, in terms of any social services, that's the same approach Republicans take in this country, too, is to humiliate anybody who might need public assistance. But, you know, beyond that, if you want to look at the impact of what humiliation means, look at Palestine and Israel, because that is by far, even more so than the random violence. That is the dynamic that drives the violence in Palestine and Israel, is the insistence day after day, hour after hour, of the Israelis in trying to break the Palestinian population through systematic, ongoing humiliation. And if you have that same kind of dynamic being set up with the United States occupying forces and Iraq, you're going to see the same kind of response.
And we're beginning to see that.
You're going to see a response of resentment, of hostility, and eventually you're going to see guerrilla warfare. You're going to see suicide bombings. You're going to see guerrilla groups. You're going to see systematic, you know, attacks against the United States. And again, we're already beginning to see that with a population that is much more armed, much more accustomed to warfare, and has much more reason to want the foreign occupiers out.
All right. Moving along, the Iraqi people are suffering, but quickly, there is some companies that are doing well, one of them being Halliburton.
Excuse me.
And Halliburton and Bechtel, how about that?
Yeah, this week it was discovered that Halliburton, it was leaked by a military staff officer, that the Halliburton subsidiary, Kellogg Brown & Root, which goes by the acronym KBR, will not just cap oil well fires in that contract that we talked about earlier.
The one that went out without bid.
Mm-hmm, that went out without bid. But they will also control the operation of Iraqi oil fields and the distribution of Iraqi oil. Now, that's an immense...
Oh, by the way!
Yeah, that's an immense expansion of their duties under that contract. I didn't realize it was that big, and most folks didn't realize it was that big. Now, what we found out, too, is that... we know that KBR won the contract without a formal bidding process. It was just given to them by the Pentagon. But KBR has been involved in overcharging the U.S. government in contracts in other places, like Kosovo, for example, where they would charge $80 for like a $15 piece of plywood. But there's a $7 billion cost ceiling on this contract. That gives you some idea of how much money the U.S. military thinks it's going to take in order to get the Iraqi oil infrastructure up and running. $7 billion, which is nowhere near what the original estimate for this contract was. Now, it also has come to people's attention this week, too, that KBR has a lesser-known but equally lucrative, if not more so, contract with the Pentagon. And that's called the Logistics Civil Augmentation Program, to help set up, supply, and cater to the U.S.-controlled post-war administration in Iraq. Now, this contract has no cost ceiling. There's no upper limit to what they can charge under this contract. And the contract can run for as long as 10 years, which gives you some idea of how long they think this is going to take.
And now cost ceilings are supposed to be a routine part of Pentagon
they
and defense
are.
Contracts, but in this case, for some peculiar reason, it was just left out entirely.
That's right. And the initial order that was made with KBR from the Pentagon was for $69.5 million to supply office furniture, computers, et cetera, to the new administration in Iraq. So far, KBR has billed the Pentagon $90 million under the contract.
Already?
Already. Well, one of their main duties is to refurbish this extravagant, you know, fortress-like presidential compound where our U.S. generals and the U.S. viceroy have set up their offices.
Are you suggesting that we're being looted?
I think the U.S. Treasury is being looted. Yes, I do.
All those gold-plated items that were removed need to be replaced somehow.
Yeah, and so, I want to stress that this contract, too, was supposed to hire Iraqis to work for the administration, and KBR has hired mostly Kuwaitis and Saudis to work for them. So I'm wondering if there wasn't a little tip-off or trade-off there for Kuwaiti and Saudi support for the war.
Okay, well, speaking of infrastructure, here in our state, we're in dire need of some, and we talked about some of the budgeting last week, but we're going to go into a little more of the transportation package details.
Yeah, because what has been coming out over the last week with the transportation deal that was settled in Olympia is the actual list of what transportation items are up for sale on that, or rather up for for being addressed on that. Now, the transportation bill that is probably going to go to voters, if not this year, the next, because Tim Iman is already collecting signatures to try and challenge the 5 cent a gallon gas tax. But the 5 cent a gallon gas tax and the other revenue pieces that are going to fund this bill have gotten most of the attention. Much less of the attention has gone into what is going to be funded with the $3.9 billion, I believe that it is, as opposed to the $4 billion as opposed to $7.8 billion for referendum 51. It's about half the size of the statewide measure that was put on the ballot last fall and beaten badly. And then there will be a regional transportation package that will probably go on the ballot sometime next spring, in spring 2004. It will not be on the ballot this fall, almost certainly at this point. There are some significant differences between referendum 51 and the bill that was passed, but most of those differences are in response to that component of the electorate that defeated referendum 51 that was responding to the gas tax. Basically, it was the anti-tax crowd, and the legislators heard that anti-tax message loud and clear. That's why you wound up with a much smaller package, the 5 cent gas tax and so forth. But here in the three most populous counties in Washington State, in King, Pierce, and Snohomish, an awful lot of the no vote for referendum 51 was also based on the opposition of environmental groups and people's concerns around the environmental impact of a very, very roads-heavy package, a package that, in the case of referendum 51, invested a lot of money in mega projects. They did the little down payment bait and switch, where we'll fund a little bit of a project now and then come back to voters later. And since the construction is already underway, we hope that the voters will just fund the rest of it. They haven't pulled that trick this time, and that's what they're counting on, is being able to point and say, well, everything that we're funding is going to be done within 10 years and none of it is a partial project. But in terms of the environmental impact, and these are almost all projects that are in the Tri-County region, most of the major roads projects in Washington State, in fact, are in the three most populated counties. That's where most of the gridlock is. But the environmental message was pretty much ignored. It is every bit as roads heavy as the package in referendum 51 was. It does not do very much for the large long-term mega projects, things like the Alaskan Way Viaduct, which gets very little funding. I-405 does get some, about $500 million worth of funding. But at the same time, almost all of the roads capacity, and as I say, the percentage of this that goes toward roads is almost identical to the percentage in referendum 51. Almost all of it goes to building new capacity. No money at all in this package goes to maintenance. It goes to fixing the already decaying infrastructure of roads that are really at or past the end of their usable life. Number one on that list, of course, and it's going to be terrifying when that bill comes due, which is really not looked at seriously yet, is that I-5 all the way through Seattle needs complete reconstruction. I mean, all the way down to the soil, it needs to be built up and rebuilt, because it's past the end of its expected life, and that expected life over 40 years ago was assuming a traffic load that's much less than being is built right now. But, you know, even without that, none of the regular maintenance that needs to be done to try and repair some of these existing roads is in this package. So it's still a package where a lot of money that needs to be spent is gonna have to come out of taxpayers' pockets some other way, or it just isn't going to be done. And it is every bit as destructive environmentally in terms of the new capacity that's adding, the roads, the lanes that it's adding, an entire north-south freeway in Spokane is being built that again has some fairly serious environmental and safety concerns, some wetlands issues around a number of the things around I-405 and 167. You know, a number of ways in which environmental groups that are starting to take a look at this package are saying, oh my gosh, this is just as bad as referendum 51 was.
All right. Well, since you're not going to be here next week, we would normally talk about this closer to the event, but since you're not going to be here, the LEIU, EIEIO.
No, it's L-E-I-U, actually. It's not even the French pronunciation. It's just a string of vowels. The Law Enforcement Intelligence Unit, and folks are going to be hearing more about this in the next couple of weeks, because this is a private organization, and I also wrote a column about it that'll be in the Weekly next week, and I think that's actually neat to state this week also. It is a private organization that is having its 48th annual training seminar that will be this year in Seattle. It's a private sort of trade group that goes all around the country. It's a trade group of law enforcement agencies, in other words, of public organizations. But because even though it gets all of its money by dues from these public agencies, it is itself private, so there's no transparency. They can be private. They don't have to make public any of their records in terms of what they spend their money on, any of these sorts of things. And the specific purpose of this agency is to exchange domestic intelligence, originally set up to monitor organized crime and expand exchange information on that. Over the years, it's been expanded to a number of other things over the past half century or so. It started in the 50s. The theme this year, what they're training for this year, is to combat the war on terrorism. Now, the interesting thing about the LAIU, and it's why a number of different groups are planning to have protests around it this year, and there's a fair amount of buzz on it on the internet at this point, is that nobody really knows what the LAIU is doing in terms of the war on terrorism. It was implicated in the 70s in a number of COINTELPRO investigations, both from the General Accounting Office nationally in terms of its work with the FBI, and then also in Chicago and Detroit and a number of other local police accountability investigations, where it was shown that the LIU was served as a conduit to get around local intelligence ordinances, such as the one we have in Seattle, that forbid law enforcement agencies from investigating people because of their political beliefs, or if they aren't in fact suspected criminals. It is part of this maze of sort of shadowy private groups that law enforcement agencies use to collect and exchange information, frequently inaccurate information, on private citizens. And the amazing thing is that since these investigations in the 70s, the LAIU has gone on for about 30 years, and there is virtually no public record on what they have been doing for that period. There is no record during the 1980s, when some of their original patrons, they were expanded in the 60s. It started in California under Governor Reagan and his executive assistant, a guy named Ed Meese, when they rose to federal power in the 80s. There's no record on what the LAIU was doing. There's no record on it during the Clinton administration. And there's no record on what it's been doing under John Ashcroft and under the new regulations post 9/11 that allow spying on domestic dissidents, allow spying on religious groups because of their religious beliefs. So there's almost no public access to what the LAIU will be doing in Seattle this year. It's June 2nd to June 6th here in Seattle. There is a website for their training seminar where you can come and see who's coming. Tom Ridge of Homeland Security fame is the invited keynote, although I don't know whether he's going to be coming or not. They usually don't confirm his public schedule. And they have a whole host of other confirmed speakers, all of whom have ties to some very interesting domestic surveillance and security type groups. I encourage people to check it out.
All right. Just about done, but kind of related to that, I don't know if you heard, I'm sure you did, since you guys are a little more in the know than a lot of people. Top Off 2. Do you know, heard about that happening Monday? Oh my God.
No,
we stumped the panel.
No.
They both. Yeah. That silence was quizzical looks from Java and Maria, so we apologize.
It sounds kind of familiar.
It is the simulation of a dirty bomb.
Oh, right. Of course. Yes.
Yeah, that'll be happening.
Yeah,
all that good
taxpayer money to convince people that the terrorist attack is right around the corner.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is, too, is it's not going to be a real useful simulation when everybody knows it's going to happen, which the city has made sure that everybody will know it's going to happen so it won't disrupt traffic. And so
we don't want to scare anybody, and we want to make sure that everybody knows exactly what's going on and when it's going on, but we think it'll be a realistic simulation.
We don't want to swap the 911 call centers on a day when they might actually have to deal with real emergencies, so we'll let everybody know it's happening.
And interesting that they focus on, you know, the potential of a dirty bomb. Meanwhile, their plans to bring nuclear waste up and down I-5 doesn't seem to be, you know, stalled too much.
By truck, yeah.
Well, and
thousands and thousands
of trucks. On an aging freeway.
Yeah, and we also aren't paying much attention to the risk that's posed by having more, really more active military facilities around a major city than any other major city in the country. Look, you know, everything from the Trident submarines to all the different Boeing facilities to all the different Navy and Air Force facilities. It's remarkable the number of targets here, but we're not going to pay attention to those. We're just going to assume they're going to go after, you know, the Space Needle or something.
With a dirty bomb.
Yeah.
All right. Well, with that, we are out of time. Talking once again with Jav Parrish, Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And quickly, where can people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, and other places where you can find free publications. You can also find us on the web at www.eatthestate. That's all one word, eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, you want to volunteer, or you just want to rant and rave at us, you can call our message line at 206-903-9461.